It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, most of downtown Racine is a food desert. And as the seasons change, access to healthy food can become even more difficult.
First, a report that was years in the making was finally released today, detailing the CIA's torture of suspected terrorists in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. Many of the findings in the report are already well known, but the difficult details have been left up to the imagination until now.
The report's release was the subject of fierce political debate in recent years. Supporters of the release say Americans deserve to know what was done to terror suspects in the name of their country, but critics say that the release threatens Americans abroad, and releasing the report during a time of war is a reckless action with possibly serious consequences.
Mike German joins us now. He's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. He's also a former FBI agent. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This report is being billed by the New York Times and others as potentially pretty damning of the CIA. How is this report going over so far at home and abroad?
So I think it's going over pretty well. I mean, I think it was helped by Senator John McCain's statement that showed that there was some bipartisanship in the decision to release the report and the necessity of the report. So, as you said in the lead-in, none of the information is necessarily new. Certainly, there are significant new details, particularly the extent to which the CIA produced misleading information both to the White House, the Department of Justice, in seeking legal authorities, but also to Congress and to the American public.
This report was 5 years in the making. What's gone into it?
A considerable bit has gone into it. It's really kind of astonishing that the oversight committee that's responsible for overseeing the CIA had such a difficult struggle to obtain information about this program. In fact, it didn't actually start until years after the program was already underway because the CIA restricted the amount of information they would give to their congressional overseers. And then once they noticed some discrepancies in what had been reported to them, they attempted to start the investigation. But as you said, it took years. And in the meantime, the CIA did all it could to resist requests for information, number one, and then actually even spied on the congressional staff that was doing the investigation. So it's really quite an achievement on the one hand that even under that resistance, they were able to get a very thorough report completed and produced. But I think it also shows the weakness of oversight, that here we are more than a dozen years after this program that had such miserable consequences was initiated, we're only now getting to see the details of it.
And what would you say the most significant details are?
From my mind, I'm very focused on government accountability, so the fact that there was so much misinformation being provided by the CIA to those responsible for ensuring the legality of the program and those responsible for ensuring that the program was run in an appropriate manner in Congress is really problematic because, of course, oversight doesn't work and our legal system can't work if the government actually lies about what's happening. So that's certainly problematic. Certainly the details and the extent of the brutality involved tend to undermine a lot of the previous statements coming out of CIA about how narrowly tailored and clinical this program was operated. But, you know, in my mind, torture is torture, and levels of torture I don't think are really very helpful. I think what's most important is that the legal justification was based on false premises.
In terms of what the CIA is now accountable for, based on this report, what do you think they're looking at in terms of response and maybe changes?
I think there will be significant changes. At least I hope there will be. Hopefully this is an initial opening. I mean, one of the interesting things that I've found doing this work is that once some information comes out, all of a sudden you'll see the CIA declassify more and more information to try to expand the argument and try to make its point, and that tends to create a flood of information coming out because organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union, which I previously worked for, have long been attempting to get information out of the CIA about this program. So every time the agency releases something on its own, it undermines its arguments in the courts to keep that information secret. So I think what we'll see is more and more information coming out, and finally an opportunity for the American public to get a true look at what happened so that we can make sure this never happens again.
And you referenced some of the levels of torture in the report, and it is difficult reading. There's some graphic descriptions of some pretty difficult-to-read things here, some brutal things. Do you think it's important that Americans have access to this information and to understand these details?
I think it is important. I mean, these were activities that were undertaken in our name, and to the extent that we're responsible for what our government does as a democracy, I think it's very critically important that we understand these details and we understand both the how it came to be and who is responsible for it, so they can be held accountable to the greatest degree possible, if nothing else, at least as a political matter and a historical matter.
Now, the report concludes that the CIA's tactics didn't gather useful information to save American lives, something that is being disputed by current and former CIA officials. But do we have a firm answer to that question at the end of the report, do you think?
I think we do. And I think it's something that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. In fact, one of the things the report does very well is indicate that there were many people within the CIA and much previous research done about the use of these kinds of techniques and the fact that they tend to produce erroneous information, false information, fabricated information rather than truth. And to the extent that they sometimes produce true information, that makes it very difficult when so much information is flawed for the agency to then decide what is true and what isn't. So even if you took away the legal and moral arguments, the lack of effectiveness, I think, should have, and there were many people within the CIA telling them that this was ineffective, both that it would be and then as it was proceeding that it was ineffective, and yet that information was sanitized from reports that were pushed up the chain of command.
Would you say that this release of this report indicates from the United States an anti-torture stance moving on forward, or does it leave the door open for more interpretation, more discussion?
Hopefully it is a closed door. Unfortunately, there certainly are opportunities for slippage, and one of the areas that we've long been concerned about is this area of proxy detention, where the U.S. government has sort of left, as you say, a door open where interrogations are happening under the request of the U.S. government, but actually under the control of a foreign government. And, of course, in many of the places where the U.S. is engaged militarily, there is little or no government authority. So sometimes that government control is in name only, and if the U.S. is engaging in these proxy detentions and feels that it is not responsible for the treatment of the detainees in that detention, that certainly opens the door to abuse.
One question about this report has been whether it heightens the risk of violence, retaliation, anything along those lines for U.S. interests abroad, service people, diplomats. Do you see this as being a serious risk for the United States?
I think Senator John McCain's statement on this was exactly right. First, that the people who have been involved in anti-U.S. violence around the world don't need much of an excuse. And second, this is not new to them. The people that were victims of the CIA torture program weren't in the dark about that. They knew about it. You know, this was really being kept secret just from the American public. So this is nothing new to anyone around the world. And, like Senator McCain said, it might not be surprising that some terrorist or other anti the person who doesn't like the United States would cling to this as an excuse, but that's been happening for many years now. Right? This, none of this has been secret, and really my question to the CIA is that was entirely predictable and should have been part of the risk management that was put in place when they decided to do this program in the first place. So they should have foreseen this consequence and therefore not engaged in this type of activity to avoid that kind of security concern.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking to Mike German. He is a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice, Liberty, and National Security Program and a former FBI agent. The U.S. Department of Agriculture publishes a map of all the food deserts in the country. If you zoom in on Wisconsin and keep zooming in on Racine, you'll see that almost all of downtown Racine is a food desert.
A food desert is classified as a place where access to healthy, fresh, and affordable food is limited. And in this particular case, the USDA considers a food desert to be where a significant share of the residents are more than a mile from the supermarket in an urban area.
During the summer's months, farmers markets, community gardens can help fill in the gaps in the availability of fresh produce. But now that the seasons have changed, fresh food is harder to come by.
Dottie K. Bowersox is with us to talk about the challenges of food deserts. She's the public health administrator for the City of Racine Health Department. Dottie K., welcome to Central Time.
Oh, well, thank you.
So tell us, where can you find fresh produce in downtown Racine? How difficult is it?
It's difficult. In order to find the fresh produce, you're going to have to travel to one of the major grocery stores outside the confines of the city limit. There are some of the smaller convenience stores that have a limited amount, but you're going to be paying a premium price for those products.
So can you paint a picture for what has led to this? Why in the heart of a city such as Racine, there isn't a grocery store?
Well, we have one small grocery store on the very edge of the downtown area, which services the entire area, thus being the food desert. At the same point, access is a huge issue. I mean, when you're looking at the larger retailers and looking at the smaller retailers, the larger retailers need space. The city of Racine, as many cities throughout the country, is landlocked, meaning that we have a premium on our space. So for the store, for the parking lot, we don't have a lot of area in which they can encompass, and therefore, they're not coming to this area. It makes it difficult, too, for the larger venues. They've got distribution. They've got more stores. They can get cheaper prices versus some of the smaller venues in which the prices are going to be increased.
Mm-hmm. So what is the access to transportation like for those who might be living closer to that downtown area?
Yeah, it's going to be limited. If you don't have a car, if you're impoverished and you don't have a car, it's very difficult to get to a grocery store. I mean, you're going to be walking, which it's not going to be a short walk, which, you know, everybody should get 30 minutes of exercise every day. At the same point, as you're walking several miles to the grocery store, you've got your bags, you might have your children, you've got to get there and back. And it's, again, it's not going to be a short walk. You're going to have a vehicle in which you're going to have the expenses, obviously, that go along with the maintaining of the vehicle, or you're going to have family and friends in which you can go together and go back and forth and depend on them to provide the transportation. We do have a public bus system, but then you're going to have to be very good about scheduling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you miss it, you're going to wait another hour. If you get there too soon, you're going to be standing out in the cold. We don't have a lot of our stops that have shelters. And so, again, you're going to be standing out in the Wisconsin wind.
In the summer, how, I guess, is it easier to get food? Is there a downtown farmer's market, for instance?
Oh, yeah, excellent. Yes, we have a downtown farmer's market, and we also have a network of urban gardeners. And if any of them are listening today, I commend every single one of them for their efforts. The city facilitates property and land in the city for them, and they have the opportunity to have a garden area in which they can grow produce. Obviously, they have to plant and they have to maintain, but it's a collaborative that has worked very well here.
So given that, you've got urban gardeners, you've got a farmer's market, what can be done, and I guess not just in Racine, but perhaps in other cities who see similar challenges, what can be done to prepare and to store the harvest from the summer and keep it available over the winter in winter farmers markets?
Yeah, well, for individuals, they can get information obviously online, and they can get information through the Extension Center, the Bureau, Extension Bureau, for how to can, how to freeze, how to maintain. But individuals also need to have an understanding and education on how to do that, and an awareness about the fresh produce and how valuable it is to their health and well-being.
I'm wondering what health consequences are there to a community that might be living in a food desert. Are you aware?
Yeah, well, they're varied. There's a lot of research statistical information about that, some of it contradictory. But at the same point, if you're looking at the smaller convenience stores, on many of them, when you walk in, the first thing you see are the liquor options. Then you see the cigarettes, then you see the lotto, and then you've got the entertainment or the amusement, gambling machines, and all of that is surrounded by processed foods. Within that processed food, we're talking about high calories, we're talking sugars, salt, fat, any sort of artificial ingredient that you possibly could probably, try to come up with. And then within that, you might have some area where you've got a limited amount of fresh produce. So it's very difficult, when you don't have transportation, when you are impoverished, to be able to get out of that cycle of looking at those processed foods and thinking that's a good option for you. And it's not only the potato chips and those type of snack foods, but we're talking, the meat, we're talking any of the TV dinners, anything along those lines that aren't fresh.
As the health coordinator for the city of Racine, are you seeing poor health outcomes in Racine?
Yes. The city of Racine, a lot of our statistical information is not good on our health. Our rankings in the state of Wisconsin is not high, and we do have a high level of obesity in the city. At the same point, part of that has to do with eating and part of that has to do with exercise.
Mm-hmm. Are leaders in the community aware of the limited access to healthy food? And if so, what are they doing about it?
Yeah, I'm confident that, we're all aware that in order to get to a grocery store, we have to get in our cars or we walk or take a bus to go to that destination. So that I am confident. The other venue, as I already mentioned, is with the property for the urban gardens. We're also looking at changing our ordinance and allowing urban chickens at this point. we've got several months in that process, but if individuals would like to engage, that'll be an opportunity for fresh eggs for their families. And also, I'm positive if a retailer wants to come and have discussion about being located in the city, I am confident we would enjoy that discussion with them.
When it comes to public health initiatives to improve health and diet, without access to healthy food, are messages lost? Are you kind of starting from the ground up?
The city of Racine, along with many communities, I would say yes. It's we're looking at if we're looking at poverty levels and poverty guidelines for this year, for 2014, a family of four to be considered impoverished, their annual income is a little bit under $24,000 annually for four, which is about $2,000 a month. Stats show that about 10% of your annual income should go to food, which is about $200 a month for a family of four. So, if you're taking a look at options for food, you're also going to be looking at how much money you have to spend. Now, there are subsidized programs, the SNAP program, the WIC program. If you meet all the eligibility factors, that might be another $200 that you could add to the coffers on a monthly basis. But again, for a family of four, for $100 a month, and $100 doesn't go far. So you're really going to be looking at foods that, you can get in bigger quantities, that you can get a cheaper price. And milk would be one of the prime examples. In some areas, it's almost $4 a gallon, which if you're taking a look at a carbonated beverage, you can get a big bottle of that for like $1. And it's the same sort of thing with all other food products. You're really going to be trying to make that $100 for that family of four go just as far as possible every single month. And it can be a very daunting adventure.
Real briefly, what lessons are you trying to take away from other cities that are facing similar situations?
Collaboration would be the biggest thing, really innovation, taking a look at how you can use your existing resources to really modify them and expand them, which, you know, again, the chickens, the urban gardens would be fine examples of that. You know, having more people engaged, getting the word out, having them understand what a real benefit this can be, and again, that's done through awareness and education and then those efforts.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
For the opportunity. It's been a sincere pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dottie K. Bowersox. She's Public Health Administrator for the City of Racine. We live in a society with youth, obsessed with youth. As for getting older, most of us associate it with a lot of dreary outcomes, like being lonely, depressed, and less productive at work. But a new body of scientific research shows that we're wrong about a lot of those assumptions. In fact, in a lot of areas, getting older corresponds to living a more satisfying life.
Here to share some of the findings with us is Ann Turgeson. She writes about retirement for the Wall Street Journal. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what are some of the most common assumptions people have about aging?
Oh, there's so many of them. But one is, you know, that older workers aren't very productive, that they're kind of stuck in their ways and they don't go with the flow or make changes. So their productivity is lower than that of younger workers. Another is that cognitive decline is inevitable. A third is that we're more depressed as we get older. We're lonelier. Those are some of the, I think, the most common ones.
And there's a lot of new scientific research out there, though, that's contradicting a lot of the assumptions we have about what getting older is actually like. What are some of the biggest findings?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting when it comes to productivity, which is a big concern of Wall Street Journal readers. These studies that sort of review other studies that have been done. They look at a large number of studies that have been done. And by and large, the findings are that there's virtually no relationship between age and job performance. And actually, some studies show that for jobs that require experience, as most jobs do, that older workers actually have a performance edge because obviously they have more experience. So that's one area.
Well, to dig into some of the findings on a deeper level, something that a lot of people project that they might feel, be more concerned about as they age, or they might struggle with, is depression. What do we know about how likely we are to be depressed as we age?
Yeah, so actually there's been a large number of studies that have been done, not just, you know, in very recent years, but over the past 20 years or so. And there's pretty much consensus among a lot of the scientists who study this that older adults are generally happier than younger adults are. Their depression rates are actually lower. In fact, this is backed up by national data. I looked at some data from the National Institutes of Mental Health, and if you look at, you know, rates of major depressive episodes, only 5.5% of people 50 or older said they'd experienced one in 2012. In contrast, for younger people, the rates were higher. For people 18 to 25, in fact, the number was almost double that of the rate for people 50 and older. So you can see that depression actually is more of a problem for younger people than it is for older people. I mean, that's not to say that no older people are depressed and that no older people sort of conform to the stereotype. But if you look at, you know, the odds on the whole, older people, generally speaking, are more satisfied with life and they're happier.
Do we know why that is? Why there would be more rates of depression in younger people than older people? Are there different mental habits that older people have?
Yeah, so anyway, the psychologists who I speak to have a theory, and it's called the positivity theory, and it goes like this, that older adults, that as you age, your focus, your psychological focus kind of changes. So as you're younger, you're much more focused on gaining new experiences that can sort of expand your horizons. As you get older, you're actually more, you prioritize more emotional meaning and satisfaction. You really prioritize happiness in a way. So there's more of an incentive to see the good rather than the bad in situations. Older people just tend not to get as caught up in sort of the drama of, you know, sort of small little bumps along the way. They have more of a perspective that, hey, I've seen this before. This is a bummer, but I can kind of weather it. They maybe have more confidence. And, you know, they're looking to spend more time with the pursuits and the people who make them happy. And so in some ways, they kind of self-select their environment a little bit more.
And how about relationships? Do they have anything to do with this? As people get older, we hear often about isolation being a hazard for people who are aging. Is that something that holds true?
So actually, there's another area where that, you know, the loneliness, the myth of the idea of loneliness afflicting older people to a greater extent is really a myth. And so there's been a number of studies in this area as well, and there's a large degree of consensus here that older adults, you know, have better marriages, they have more supportive friendships, they have less conflict with other people. It's really interesting. There's actually a study that a researcher at Stanford University, she's a psychology professor at Stanford University, she did, and she looked at close to 200 people, and she followed them for many years, and she asked them to put their friends and relatives into three categories. They had the inner circle, which was people they're very, very close to, and they so close they couldn't imagine life without them. Then there's sort of a middle circle of people who they feel very, very close to, but a little bit less, and then an outer circle. And they asked these people to rate on a scale of 1 to 7 their positive and negative emotions that they felt for each of the people in their social network. And what they found is as they tracked these people over time, their ratio of positive to negative emotions associations with their people in their networks grew. So they, you know, they became increasingly positive about the people who they'd had ties to. And over time, they actually reduced the number of people in their social circles, but they retained their closest ties. So what this sort of says is that over time, as people age, they tend to maintain their contacts with the people who provide them with the most satisfaction in terms of their relationship.
Would you say that overall, looking at this new research, it's a compilation from lots of different sources, but does it seem to indicate that when you are in those years that you might think of as something you're not looking forward to, but you know, your late 60s, your 70s, your 80s, your 90s, that these can be some of the most fulfilling times of your life?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it seems like as people get older, they kind of know themselves better. I mean, sort of in layman's terms, they know themselves better. They know they know what their priorities are, and they're not really as hung up on maintaining appearances and sort of bending over backwards to meet somebody for lunch because they don't want to hurt someone's feelings. I mean, they're more able to sort of deal with some of the social nuances there. And so I think people over time definitely are better positioned to have more satisfying experiences.
We're talking right now with Ann Turgeson. She writes about retirement for the Wall Street Journal, and we're looking at new research that shows a lot of our preconceptions about aging, worries about things like loneliness and depression and cognitive decline, are turning out to be unfounded, according to some new research.
And we want to hear from you. Are the golden years, the late 60s, the 70s, and onward, better than you thought that they would be? Are there areas of your life now that are better than they were when you were younger? What's your experience in terms of loneliness, creativity, and relationships? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Ann Turgeson. She writes about retirement for the Wall Street Journal. Recently, she took a look at research showing that people who, as they age, are more fulfilled, leading more satisfying lives than they may have thought they'd lead. Worries about loneliness, depression, cognitive decline turn out to be not as big an issue as people may have projected, according to some new research.
And we want to know if this has been your experience or not. Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Rita on the line with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I wanted to say that getting older all really depends upon what kind of health and physical condition you're in. If you're feeling pretty good and you don't have any major problems, you've more or less come to terms with life's ups and downs. But if you're not well, you can't cope with any of it as you start to hit 90.
Well, Rita, thank you for that perspective. And that's something I think the researchers looked at about health issues. How much does health weigh when you consider these different factors, Anne?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that health plays a big role in overall happiness and satisfaction. So, you know, a lot of these studies looked at, they adjusted for differences in health, and so they tried to look at these underlying factors in isolation. But, I mean, I think, you know, in reality, the caller raises a very good point.
Well, to look at one aspect of health, one area that you looked at in terms of the research is exercise. And one of the myths of getting older is that more exercise is better. And there's a little bit of good news there for people who can't exercise quite as much as they maybe could have when they were young.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's important to make it clear that when it comes to improving health and longevity, exercise is key. And so, you know, nobody's saying, oh, don't bother with exercise. But in fact, you know, there are sort of a number of studies that have been done in very recent years that show that there is possibly or likely a diminishing return to exercise, so that the more you exercise, you're not getting nearly the benefits for the extra that you're doing. And in some studies actually show that there could be, that it could actually backfire on you if you sort of exercise in an extreme way. So, you know, we're talking about sizable amounts of exercise.
So get your exercise, but it's not necessarily to do huge amounts.
Yeah, and actually some studies have actually pegged, you know, sort of moderate exercise as the best. It's sort of the sweet spot.
Well, Rita, again, thanks a lot for your comments and your thoughts there. We're going to go next to Barbara joining us in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I just want to say I'm 65 years old. I work full time. I have fairly good health, and I'm enjoying my life much more now than I did 20 or 25 years ago.
So, how come? Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't have the pressures of day-to-day parenting. I can enjoy my grandchildren and send them home. My hormones aren't all out of kilter, so, you know, I don't worry about my love life as much anymore. And I just feel a sense of satisfaction.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Barbara. Appreciate hearing about your experience. And what I hear Barbara saying is that she's got time to take care of herself, and she's not sweating some of the dramatic ups and downs that preoccupy us so much, you know, when we're in our 20s or something.
That makes sense.
Do you see that as being typical of the people who responded to these surveys and were part of this research?
Well, it's really hard for me to actually know that, because I didn't, I think a lot of the researchers, too, didn't sort of, you know, they kind of looked at the data, and they asked people to do things. Like, for example, this one study that researchers at Stanford did is they handed out beepers to about 200 adults who are between ages of 18 and 94. And for 1 week, at 5 randomly selected times in each day, they would page each of these participants, and the participants would fill out questionnaires asking them to assess, you know, how much they were feeling of different emotions, like anger and sadness and boredom and joy. And so they had to do these assessments 5 times a day. And what the researchers did was they compiled those, they looked at those questionnaires, and then they did the same thing with the same participants 5 years later and 10 years later. And what they found was that over time, as the participants aged, the ratio of positive to negative emotions steadily improved. So you were getting more positive emotions throughout the day as people got older. So that's kind of, you know, I don't think they have the perspective that your participant did in terms of looking at the ins and outs of these people's lives, but they really tried to sort of get data that showed, you know, a trend in terms of emotional satisfaction.
Well, one of the things that the people talk about as one of the prizes of the golden years of getting older is wisdom. Is there something to that? Are people older and wiser as they get older?
Yeah, actually, so there's a really interesting study that came out in 2010, and it's by, again, a group of psychologists. One of the authors I spoke to was at the University of Waterloo, and that's exactly what they found, that 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 older people who they tested were rated higher in terms of wisdom by reviewers. So what they did was they took about 250 people, all Midwesterners, so they're probably all your readers, and they read them stories about conflicts between individuals and between social groups, and they asked them to predict the outcomes. And so what they did was they transcribed what people had to say, and they took all references to their identities, including their names and ages, off, and they asked reviewers, people who had been specially trained in how to rate their responses to do that, and they actually asked people who are in the clergy and professional counselors to actually also weigh in. And what they determined was that when they looked at the scores of the top-scoring people, the average age of the people in the top, the 20% with the highest scores, was 65. The average age for the bottom 80% was 45. So, you know, right there they showed that the older people tended to give wiser responses.
So, and just briefly as we wrap up, would you say that the takeaway here is that those of us heading into those years or maybe worried about them, is a takeaway that maybe there's not so much to be fearful about, that these can be years to look forward to?
Yeah, I think there's not. And I think it's also very important, though, to do what your first caller, to keep in mind the point that your first caller made, that a lot is also going to depend on your physical health. So to the extent that you can control that, maybe with some moderate exercise and, you know, listening to your doctor, then that will really position you well to have a very kind of happy and satisfying later life.
And thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ann Turgeson. She writes about retirement for the Wall Street Journal. On Central Time, we're always looking to cover the stories that matter the most to you. One of our producers, Galen Druk, is joining us now to talk about how you can have more of an impact about what you hear on Central Time. Hey, Galen.
Hey, guys. So I'm a producer on the show, and that means that my job is to find the people, issues, and questions around the state that matter to you. I hope we do a good job of that, but there's also no better way to cover the things that matter to you than to hear those things, well, directly from you. So I'm here with a request. We want your input. Tell us about the people who are making a difference in your community, the concerns you have in the state or in your county. Tell us the questions you have that nobody else is asking or really answering.
And Galen, how can people get in touch with you with those ideas?
All right, there are a couple ways. So Facebook, you can go to the Central Time Facebook page and send us a message or post on our wall. You can also send an email to centraltime@wpr.org. And then we also have a hotline number, and that's 855-683-4522. That's 855-683-4522. And we can't wait to hear your input.